Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
From Variety, celebrating more than 115 years covering the business of entertainment, this is the Award Circuit Podcast.
Honestly, if you ask me then, do I want to win the lottery or do I want to win this role, I would have told you without a doubt I wanted this. That's how hungry I was for this. How eager I was for it. And it's been incredible since.
Kiyu Kwan is still remembered fondly for his childhood roles in films such as The Goonies and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Now, he's making a comeback in a big way with roles including the hit film Everything Everywhere All at Once. I'm Clayton Davis. On this week's episode of the award-winning Variety Award Circuit Podcast, we sit down with Kiyu Kwan and talk about his fascinating career. Later, we chat with actor Ben Foster about his new film, Emancipation, which also stars Will Smith. But first, the roundtable discusses new contenders, including Babylon from Damien Chazelle and Glass Onion from Rian Johnson. It's all next on this edition of the Variety Award Circuit Podcast. Stay close.
Well, hi, everyone. It is Variety TV editor Michael Schneider, along with Janelle Riley.
First.
You're one of those awful commenters on the internets. First. And Jazz Tanke.
Second.
And bringing up the rear. Oh, that sounded wrong. That sounded inappropriate. I apologize, Clayton Davis.
Hope HR is listening. Last.
HR is not listening. So that's how we...
I believe HR listens to our podcast.
So we have to be on our best behavior.
Yeah.
Our award-nominated podcast.
Yeah, award-nominated
podcast. If they are listening, we have some apologies to make.
We do.
Yeah, we should, a lot.
Should we? Well, first off, this isn't an apology. It's more like a... sigh of relief. So last week's episode, we actually taped on election day, and all signs pointed to the end of democracy, and we were not feeling it. We were not feeling great last week. The doom and gloom, the clouds were heavy, and it just felt like, well, this is it. Nice run, America, but...
You make a plan and God laughs.
Luckily, thankfully, we apparently still do have a democracy. In many cases, sanity has prevailed, and we live to fight another day. And we'll just continue to watch this democracy slowly crumble, as opposed to all at once. So that's
we look at Janelle Riley as the Carrie Lake of Variety, right?
I don't even know what that means.
She's a monster. The filter lady. The one that Cecily Strong's going to win an Emmy for this year.
Got Vaseline on the camera.
Oh, I
in
did
the background.
See that. That was hilarious.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But so that's thing one. Thing two, Janelle does have an apology. So let's throw
for all our talk about the costume contest being rigged.
Yes, this is this,
and we never placing.
We should tell people real quick, this is the Penske, the media corporation, does a costume contest every year, and people bring their A game.
Oh my God, it's amazing.
They do fantastic. I've done it for a couple of years, have never won.
Most famously is Steve Buscemi, How Do You Do, Fellow Kids?
Yes, and then one year my wife and I actually dressed as the Pricewaterhouse accountants who screwed up the Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
And
love that.
We had a great time. But
close to home.
But this year, Janelle... First off, remind people what your costume was.
It was the Elvis Universe version of Joy from Everything Everywhere All at Once, and my pit bull Wilbur was the pig that Joy enters with. And I thought it was very clever and almost didn't even enter the contest because I never win, and because people here do enter some really impressive contests, I was like, what's even the point?
Yeah.
But I did, and I placed third.
Yes.
Oh, and the beautiful thing is they made a donation to Wags and Walks.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
Shout out.
That's the most important thing.
Yeah. So more pities will find home.
Shout out to PMC. See, HR, are you listening?
Yeah.
We love you.
We love PMC.
And just for those who obviously you can't see this, but Janelle's sweater has like the googly eyes.
It does have the googly eyes. I put those on there before there was a run on googly eyes because this was before the movie came out for a Q&A. That's how I, okay, you're outing me for not washing this sweater.
Do you wash sweaters, by the way?
I don't know.
Yeah. I dry clean them.
Yeah, well, this is dry cleaning. Like, it off. Now there's a run on googly eyes in the world, and I have like 20 of them on my sweater.
That is great. You know, it's so funny. I hadn't even noticed the googly eyes. Jazz mentioned it.
Well, I started putting them on everything, and I have this R2-D2 dress with a bunch of R2-D2s, and I put googly eyes right on the little, you know, his one little eye, and nobody even noticed. It was hilarious.
Did you put them on rocks?
I do. Well, of course. That's the obvious thing to do. Yeah. That was going to be my ultimate Halloween costume. Yeah. Just be a rock.
Actually, around my neighborhood, people have been putting googly eyes on the cactuses. So jogging by, it's it's nice cartoon characters saying hi as you're walking by.
Have you ever seen that sketch with Christopher Walken where he's the man who's afraid of plants? So he puts googly eyes on everything. He's like, people say that eyes are the doorway to the face. It's brilliant.
Yes. Yeah.
I loved your Christopher Walken impression. That was pretty
I'm so tired, y'all. And I don't even have an excuse because I didn't go to Babylon last night. Oh. But I'm exhausted.
Ooh, segue.
Segue.
Janelle with the segue.
Call her a mall cop because she's on a segue.
So Babylon. I know reviews are not allowed out yet, but social
are encouraged.
And a podcast is a social tool. So we are just sharing the social information. So is this just a pure orgy? What is this film?
It's the most movie of the year. I think that's, you could say, it's the most movie.
The most.
The most movie.
It's extra? Is that what the kids would say?
Yeah, it is.
By the way, even the negative reactions excited me.
Yeah.
Like the way that they were worded, I was like, oh, I'm going to love this.
There's a few movies this year that are going to bring about some morbid curiosity to the conversation. I think people are going to want to see it, and this is definitely going to be one of them. At a breezy 3 hours and 8 minutes.
Dear God.
3 hours and 8 minutes.
Yeah.
It's the 8 minutes,
it's
man.
It really
is the 8 minutes because when I looked to see how much time I had left, I was like 1 hour and 8 minutes, and then I knew I was at the 3 hour mark. And I was like, oh man.
Did you have to pee at some point?
I did, and I was thinking about going, and then I was like, no, I feel like I'm gonna miss something, kind of.
Yeah, because it didn't feel like there was a moment where, like, this is a pee break moment. I think we can walk out here and not miss anything.
Is there a website that tells us when a good time to go to the bathroom is in a movie? Obviously, the movie has to have been out a little while.
I feel like there was. Yeah, there was.
But if there's not, hold on.
Variety.com/bathroom breaks.
By the way, that would be a great.
I know.
Other publications are listening to this.
Other PMC brands. It's hard. People ask me if I liked it, and I don't know how to answer that. The first hour and 15 minutes, I was really on board. Like, I was like, oh, this is great.
So back it up real quick, though.
Sure.
For folks who, you know, because we have a wide variety of listeners. Mm-hmm. And some people listening
what
probably have no idea what Babylon is. So
it is.
Yeah, what is the plot?
Oh, yeah. It's a look at old Hollywood. Starts in 1927, I think.
Yeah.
Because it really starts out with a time clock and then we jump time for some reason. 1927, old Hollywood, and it's aspiring artists. Like, one's a famous actor, played by Brad Pitt. One's an aspiring actress from New Jersey, played by Margot Robbie. A Mexican man who crossed the border some years ago with his parents, that's Diego Calva. And then a bunch of other characters. And they're just in the sex, drugs, and rock and roll version of 1927 Hollywood that I've never seen depicted before. The movie, this is what you need to know. The title card doesn't come up for 30 minutes.
A page from Fresh.
It starts with elephant poop and an orgy.
A lot of orgies.
And a lot of elephant poop.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
Please tell me they're not in the same.
Yeah,
like,
that's
the
what
orgies
I was like.
I mean, there is an elephant in an orgy scene, but it is the same elephant, but he doesn't poop in the orgy.
But there is poop. It's almost like Triangle. I think somebody posted it last night, but like, Damien saw Triangle of Sadness and was like, hold my beer.
Oh, no, that was, I said, it was like Damien, someone read Sodom and Gomorrah to Damien Chazelle and he said, hold my beer.
Yeah.
And then he went all out on this. So the first hour and 15 minutes, it is, I thought a lot of Uncut Gems.
Oh, interesting.
Uncut Gems I really like. But as soon as it was over, I said to myself, I'll never watch that again because that gave me too much agita.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's how the first hour and 15 minutes are. Like, it doesn't let up. And then it does a tonal switch that doesn't work. And I think that's where it struggles the most. So there are a few great individual scenes in that last hour 45. But in a 3-hour movie, I felt like I barely knew any characters.
Do you think this changes the Oscar race at all?
No.
No.
Not in any categories?
I mean, best in show is Margot.
Lead or supporting?
She is lead. I definitely see why it was probably a question for a minute that she could be supporting because she disappears for 35
minutes.
In a
2-hour movie, would she be a lead?
I mean, I think she's lead for sure.
Yeah.
I think that she just disappears for a huge chunk of it that you just don't know what happened to her. And then she comes back randomly. She is lead. I just think it's a really beefy lead actress race.
I think it's
the penultimate drop of the season because now all that's left is Avatar at 3 hours and 11 minutes.
And Emancipation, technically.
Technically Emancipation that we're under embargo. Yeah. The crafts are great. Justin Hurwitz's score is incredible. I think that's probably the best shot it has. And then maybe production design, costume, maybe makeup. Brad Pitt, I mean, he's good. He's good.
How much of it is sort of an accurate depiction of Hollywood of that era? Is it a love letter to Hollywood?
I saw that term love letter tossed around so much yesterday.
They said it is not a love letter. It is like a terroristic threat.
Oh, no.
not necessarily in a bad way, but I will say this.
A good terroristic threat?
Hey, good terrorist. This is where I land on it, which I say this so politely and so clearly. We are in this time of Oscar-winning auteurs getting carte blanche and making what you want, and Final Cut is yours. I think we are really undervaluing and underestimating the power of a production note.
Yeah, you know, that's something we talk about a lot on the TV side, too, in the era of prestige TV. Mm-hmm. Sometimes some shows, you know, could use some executive notes. You know, the network note has become such a negative connotation, but sometimes, you know, network executives actually are good at their job.
Yeah.
And same in film, I'm sure.
And I think there is a masterful hour and 55-minute version of this movie that's a masterpiece, probably. It's a pretty mediocre, I think, 3-hour, 8-minute.
It was 4 hours originally, right?
Yeah, his original cut was 4 hours long. I'm sure he wanted to do it, too.
I know so many people who said, like, they did not mind the length. They just loved every second of it and it didn't feel long.
I wonder, I mean, would Chazelle ever be willing to do the edit version? You know, like the...
No,
the,
they only do longer versions.
The 7-inch single version of
You know what's funny? You know what Babylon? I thought of in the middle of it? Like, this totally probably should have been a miniseries, and the Eddie should have been a movie that he did for Netflix.
What's the Eddie?
Remember the Andre Holland?
Oh, that show was called... Oh, the Eddie. Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. I thought you were talking about an award.
Oh, no.
The Eddie Award.
Yeah. Well, 8 Eddies.
Eddies. I really enjoyed that series, actually.
I liked the series, but I actually think it would have made a fabulous movie. Like, I think it there was a movie in there, and this, I think, would have made a fabulous miniseries.
So is it too late for them to switch that?
I mean, we could retroactively go back. Yeah. I love Andre Holland. but yeah, I think... And there are some really problematic things that are... in some of the characters that are in my column.
Really?
That will be up by the time people are listening to this.
I guess you can't really talk about that just
yet. I mean, it's going to be up by the time.
Okay, so
no spoilers.
Yeah, no spoilers. There is, I think all the people of color characters are highly problematic in the movie because I just feel like they have no agency. They have no, if you pluck them out, nothing changes. And there's a scene with blackface that I don't think serves what he was going for. That's part of the tonal shift.
Yeah. You could have cut that and still had a 3-hour, 7-minute
movie.
I think my question at the end of that scene, like, it was really uncomfortable to watch. And I was like, why?
Mm.
Like, that was my thing.
Like why?
Why?
Although Giovanna Depo, can we just say,
oh my God,
learned to play the trumpet.
Love him.
And plays it like a master.
He's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like it.
He's really good at just being Giovanna. Like, he's a great actor. You know, you're at the mercy of what's given to you. And I think that's the issue.
Do you see much of my beloved Jean Smart?
You don't for a good amount of it. Like, at first I was like, she's just kind of movie floating wallpaper for a bit. Then she gets one good scene at the end. And this is probably my other issue. This is now, I feel like, the 10th movie in the last few years, or 10th anything, that directors are like poo-pooing journalists. Like, you don't know what we do for our art. And you don't know, you know, you don't know what it's like to create. And we're always being the bad guys. And I don't appreciate that. Like, if you're making stuff for consumers, then you're at the mercy of criticism. And that's our job, just like you have your job. And you cannot agree with us, but we're not the villains in the story. You know, if people love your film and we're wrong, then great, we own it. But we're not just the villains in this. And I feel like that's Jean Smart's purpose in the movie. Yeah.
Remember there was a film critic and someone like really didn't like him, so they named the villain in, I think it was Galaxy Quest, after him.
Oh, wait. Yeah. Is it Malcolm and Marie talk about?
Well, Malcolm and Marie was, that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was directed at someone very specific.
And Birdman does it with Iñárritu and the theater critic, the Keaton and theater critic scene.
I love that scene.
It's in Bardo this year also.
You know, but I think in Iñárritu's films, he kind of sides with the critics a lot of the time.
I mean, yeah, but in Bardo, I feel like it's much more pronounced. So Chazelle does this in the movie, and I'm kind of like, can we like stop making this like a theme? Like, guys,
Well, Clayton,
a lot of variety in the movie, though, by the way.
There is a lot of variety.
Like 10 or 11 issues of variety that get thrown on the table in quick cuts.
Are we up for best supporting
something? I mean, might as well be. I don't think I saw a byline, though. I think it was
no, there were no bylines.
Oh, boo.
Well, it would have been like 20s, so.
I mean, listen, if it said Michael Schneider, I would have died laughing, though.
1926.
To be fair, I have been working at Variety since 1929.
Yeah.
So, well, that's I'm intrigued now.
Yeah. You've only excited me more.
I think you want to see it.
But Jazz. Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Aside from the parking, what did you think?
I did have to make a comment about the parking because that was like very messy.
That's why I didn't go last night.
But I really loved it. I love those films about decadence and extravagance and just seeing Hollywood in the 1920s and the silent era, because a lot of the film is about the transitioning of, you know, putting sound into films. I thought the production design, Florencio Martin's production design, was great. I enjoyed it. Yes, there are a few problematic scenes and the editing, you know, it's like there's the ending too, which I think we discussed, but I won't spoil that. And you're like, wait, I don't get that, but I just want to hear why he did it. But no, I loved it. I can see why people didn't like it. I can see the hate tweets and why.
Tweets? Are we still on Twitter?
Yeah, that's what's left of it.
Yeah,
and that's the official mark. I would watch it again though. Like that's what I'm maybe it's gonna be film Twitter's favorite movie of all time though.
Yeah.
Of all time.
Lots of good.
There is a brilliant.
Oh yeah, for sure.
There is a brilliant. If you thought Triangle of Sadness is like vomiting poop scene was something, I think it's just been topped.
Who would have thought this year would be about severed fingers, vomiting, and poop. Dildos? Literally,
I won't say which of those relates to what I'm about to say, but that reminds me that The Menu opens this weekend, and I love this movie.
Yeah.
So please, everyone, go see it.
Elephant poop and dildos.
Yeah.
Give it away.
Wait, hold on. Mike gets to really contribute right now.
Yeah, I saw a movie.
What'd you see?
Saw a movie.
Not even just a movie at home. Please set it up better. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I went to the premiere of Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery.
Which doesn't say a Knives Out mystery at the beginning of the movie, so I kind of want them to rip that from the title.
Yeah, it's wordy.
It's very wordy.
If it's nominated for Best Picture, will it be just Glass Onion?
I don't know. I don't know. Because there was a whole argument with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and where the ellipsis came.
Oh, yeah.
In the movie, it comes after the inn. And then in the marketing, it's before the inn. So it's like
ineligible.
Yeah, ineligible.
Okay, Glass Onion.
The style questions that we have to worry about.
Rank your favorite people in the movie. Number one, who is it?
You're putting me on the spot here.
The correct answer is always Catherine Hahn.
I mean, Catherine Hahn is fantastic, but I gotta say, Janelle Monáe.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
I like me some Janelle. Yeah, too. Yeah. Janelle Riley.
She spells it differently. Yes. I can tell by how you're pronouncing it. You're talking about Janelle, as opposed to Janelle.
I mean,
Janelle's great. I think when he put like a weapon to my head, I'm gonna say Kate Hudson.
Hudson's
so good in
that. Yeah.
That walk is incredible.
I mean, they're all pretty good, you know? Starting with Daniel Craig, obviously, who unfortunately was ill and wasn't able to attend the premiere. But, you know, he's still the heart of that franchise and fantastic in this one. And the twists and turns, I mean, it's just such a fun ride. And just when you think, okay, well, I kind of see where this is going. Nope. Midway through the film, they completely drop it and like basically give you a second film, like the second half of what this is, and then you really see what's going on. It's you know, Rian Johnson, man. He,
I want that box. I want that puzzle box.
That box is a lot of fun.
It's so weird how time hop lines up sometimes, because yesterday it informed me that 3 years ago I was doing the Q&A at the Knives Out premiere. Wow. And there's the photo of, and the funny thing is, there were so many people on that panel, and like, I've actually forgotten. People were like, oh yeah, and when Don Johnson, I was like, Don Johnson was there?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, I remember that.
Maybe that was the moment where Rian Johnson saw your name and thought, Janelle Monáe.
Yeah.
And yes, where's my 20%? Exactly. You know, I did, in the hopes that I would be asked to do a Q&A with Glass Onion and Knives Out Mystery, I bought Knife hair clips, and they are just sitting there unused as of this recording.
I'm doing a Glass Onion Q&A this week.
But so am I.
Great, guys. Thanks.
I still have my big Knife magnifying glass from the first
There's some great swag. They also sent out AirPods.
Oh, really?
Remember, because when he's listening to Sondheim.
Oh, yeah.
Does he sing Sondheim in this one?
There is a Sondheim moment.
Oh, good.
It will not be spoiled. Though.
Yeah. Thank you.
But yeah, it's Edward Norton is Precious Cargo.
He's brilliant.
Yeah. Precious Cargo.
He should be doing more comedies.
I know.
Death to Smoochie, everyone. I will keep saying it. That is a great movie.
He's great. And Catherine Hahn is fantastic, and I want her in every movie.
Well, good news.
She is.
It looks like
in every movie going forward. So definitely a fun film. Is it really like in the Oscar mix?
People are saying it's better than the first one. The first one was. Yeah.
And I actually think it's better than the first one. I mean, yes, it is. There's populist movies in the race this year. It's just one of five that are in the race this year, so that's the thing.
I think you're right in that this one moves sort of faster. It's got more of a tempo than the first one, and you're really along for the ride the entire ride, where I felt like there probably were some slow moments in the first one. This one, it's not 3 hours and 8 minutes. It clips along.
It's 2:19, and that's fine.
By the way, I accidentally hit voice to text while we were all talking, and Siri thinks that Michael says, "I like having people say it's better than me."
Story of my life.
A screenplay.
It's definitely going to get adapted screenplay.
Yeah, it's going to be adapted, right?
I think that's 100% happening. I would love to see it in production design and costumes, because I think we overlook modern day sets, and that Glass Onion creation and that room.
It's spectacular. Yeah.
It's spectacular.
Yeah. And by the way, sort of stroke of genius that Netflix had their premiere at the Academy Museum, because that theater sort of looks like the Glass Onion.
Yeah.
So to have that there, sort of, that was something everyone was commenting on all night. Like, I feel like we're inside the Glass Onion while watching the Glass Onion.
And meta
for me.
And then maybe editing. Bob Doucet does a great job there. And I think the score is great, but I think it calls back too much to the original, and that branch sucks at that sometimes, unless you're John Williams, and they'll just do it every time. But I think it's on the table. I think Janelle's on the table too.
Yeah.
We'll see what they do.
Yeah. Janelle's literally on the table right now.
And by the way, like, if there's a prom king of Hollywood, Rian Johnson's probably it. And I think, like, you never know. Like, Netflix pulls rabbits out of a hat all the time.
Yeah. 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 And yeah, you're right. I mean, who doesn't love Rian Johnson right now?
He's the best.
Yeah.
He knows what he did.
Yeah. He was a guest on this podcast, so he's great.
Yes.
And then lastly, there's a strange world happening tonight also.
Yay.
Disney's newest film that comes out November 23rd. And I don't think anyone knows what it's about. And now seeing it, I understand why, because I think there's going to be a certain demographic of the world, I won't say America, the world, that will not be on board with what they have given us and the future children from the LGBTQ community.
Well, that's a shame.
Yeah. But it's really, really good.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, but you're right. I've seen the marketing and I have no idea what it's about.
Yeah. Yep. I sat down still not knowing. I was like, I don't know what I'm about to see. I don't know even the characters, but it's really well done. And I think it's definitely going to get nominated for animated feature.
Okay.
Seeing it tonight.
I don't know if it's has the goods to win, like to get past like Pinocchio or Turning Red, but I think it's going to be definitely on the table.
All right. Well, I'm still looking forward to that. And what else? What's opening this weekend?
The Inspection.
Oh, it does open.
Yes, with the fantastic Jeremy Pope.
And the fantastic
Gabrielle Union. She is fantastic. And also, we should also throw out Raul Castillo, another Gotham Award nominee.
Mm-hmm.
And Bokeem Woodbine.
I love Bokeem Woodbine.
God, He's
really
so good. He's shooting somewhere, so he wasn't able to do any of the Q&As this weekend, but every time his name was even just mentioned, people would go crazy.
Yeah. And I love him in military gear because it reminds me of The Rock.
Now, do you know who Bokeem Woodbine is, Michael?
Yeah.
Okay. He was in Fargo.
Yeah, he was
in Fargo. That's a TV
Fargo.
Show.
Yes.
Okay. Mike Milligan.
Listen, I know him from
he
Posse.
He was great as Mike Milligan.
He was so great as Mike Milligan.
I remember
Milligan.
Him from Posse.
Oh, my gosh.
He was in
Dead Presidents.
Dead Presidents.
Great actor. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, shout out to him. Shout out to all of you, by the way.
Chippendales tonight, isn't it?
So,
welcome to Chippendales.
Yeah, it's a busy week for premieres. It's Welcome to Chippendales this week. Also, Wednesday, which they're smartly actually holding the premiere on a Wednesday.
Because
I mean, it would be really dumb if they didn't.
It'd be confusing. Yeah. Wednesday on Tuesday.
Yeah.
But
And also Devotion tonight. I'm going
Devotion.
To.
Devotion.
Oh, you're finally seeing it.
I haven't seen it.
And then you will stop fighting with me when I say that it could possibly.
Fighting. I just, there's two airplane movies happening.
People more credit than that.
People really
they're
love
very
Devotion.
Different movies, yes.
They really do.
People love airplanes. So
people love Jonathan Majors.
I love B.O.B.
Oh, whoa.
Remember? No.
I like B.O.B. until it became like the King Flat Earth. Remember
true.
That?
Yeah, I do remember that. By the way, have you ever felt as old as you did when you looked at the nominees for Best New Artist at the Grammys this year?
No, because I didn't look at the list.
Yeah.
There are
did.
Names I have never heard of. These are just words that Anita, Omar Apollo, Domi and J.D. Beck, Mooney Long, Samara Joy, Lato, Maneskin.
I cannot tell you how old.
Maneskin. They won the Eurovision.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Eurovision.
Molly Tuttle and Wet Leg.
Yeah, Wet Leg. It's fantastic, too.
Look at how hip.
Well, he's teenagers.
I'm not a regular mom. I'm a cool mom. All right, Amy Poehler.
Look at suddenly Clayton.
I know.
Clayton's the dad
I
here.
Know. I've never felt so, like, disconnected. I was like, where's my, like, Doja Cat or something? But that was last year, right?
Yeah, Doja Cat's been around for a while. Yeah. You're talking new artists. Although, I don't know that whole category is
I only
always...
know Doja Cat because wasn't she thirsting after Joseph Quinn?
Yes, and
was
they
that
got,
her?
And they got upset because somebody...
yeah.
Because
one of the kids on the show
right,
revealed that.
Stranger Things, yeah.
Oh, broke my heart.
Variety 10 actor to watch.
And she also got stuck with a name on Twitter. I just remember.
Oh,
that.
I heard this.
That's right, yeah.
She like,
why did she
it.
Change her name to Christmas?
I guess to mess with the verification.
Yeah.
You can't change your name. You can't log out right now. Twitter is on, like, razor thin ice, man.
She was also on an episode of Dave last season.
That's right.
Which is an underrated show that y'all should
I Dave
is
love very good. Dave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dave.
All right. We're just like rambling on now. The listeners want to get on with things. So they've got things to do. They've got
to so get to who is this week?
This week is Kiyu Kwan. Everything, Everywhere, All at
Once.
Ah,
love him.
And Mr. Ben Foster talking Emancipation.
Excellent.
Mm.
What an interesting, eclectic show, Clayton Davis.
Award-winning, one would say.
Yes, exactly. FYC. Well, we will see you all next week for Thanksgiving, which I guess we're celebrating together on a Thursday.
Good, right. I have no plans.
Bye.
After the break, Everything Everywhere All at Once star Kiyu Kwan. From Los Angeles, this is the Variety Award Circuit Podcast. And we're back. It's the Variety Award Circuit Podcast, and I'm Clayton Davis. Kiyu Kwan, who played Harrison Ford's 11-year-old sidekick Short Round in 1984's Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, is all grown up now and ready to be an Oscar contender. Kwan has received rousing reviews for his turn as Weyman Wong, the delightfully goofy husband in the Daniels whimsical multiverse comedy Everything Everywhere All at Once. But he's also responsible for some emotionally powerful scenes as well.
The only thing I do know is that we have to be kind. Please, be kind. Especially when we don't know what's going on.
Kwan quit acting in the late 1990s. Now, the Vietnamese-born actor's career is surging. With no frontrunner for Best Supporting Actor, Kwan's name has been widely discussed. He even secured a Gotham nom back in early October. As the actor books more roles, he'll appear in The Electric State and in Marvel's upcoming Loki second season. Kwan's rising visibility in the biz will have an advantageous effect on his Oscar campaign. I recently caught up with Kwan to talk about Everything Everywhere All at Once, where his career is going next, and much, much more. We began by discussing what he's been up to in these recent years.
Wow. There's so much been happening. And honestly, ever since our movie came out, it's been amazing. Mm-hmm. It really has. I've been very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very cathartic.
Yep.
And I'm just overwhelmed with gratitude how well our movie has, you know, has done at the box office, how the audience has embraced my return to acting. For the last few months, a lot of people have come up to me and told me how much they enjoyed our movie.
Yeah.
and what it means for them to see me back up on the screen.
Yeah.
And how much they enjoyed it. It's been incredible. And I'm so happy and I'm feeling so grateful right now.
I'm glad. You know, listen, it's well deserved. Your performance in the movie is incredible. But how did you get mixed up with the Daniels? Like, that is like got to be one of the most random sentences. I would never think that they would know you to bring you out of retirement into acting. So how'd you get involved with the movie?
It's just everything. It's wonderful how everything came together. It was literally 2 weeks when I decided to get back into acting. And this is after like a year of conversation with my wife, going back and forth, whether I should do this, whether I not. Uh-huh. And it's just like prepping myself what it would mean to be an actor again. And of course, you know, all those rejections that come, you know, with being an actor. So I was just really nervous. I was, you know, 49 years old at that time. Mm-hmm. I was about to hit 50. And I felt like, you know, probably another decade would go by really quick. And I see myself turning, somehow for some reason, I see myself turning 60 and looking back, and probably if I had I not made the decision to be an actor again, I would regret it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be at a place where I would have regrets. And luckily my wife was very supportive. Mm. And you know, she told me, she prepped me about, you know, all these things that would happen. Mm-hmm. You know, like going to auditions and getting rejected again and again.
Yeah.
And finally, you know, I said, let's do it. I called up a friend of mine who is an agent.
Yeah.
And practically begged him to represent me because I didn't have an agent for decades.
Yeah.
And luckily he said yes. And 2 weeks later, I got this phone call. I got this call from the Daniels asking me to go in and audition for them. And right before I was scheduled to go in, they sent the script over. And I read it and I was, I was so... The script hit me on so many levels.
Mm-hmm.
One, it was just beautifully written. It featured a Chinese-American family, which I always wanted.
Yeah.
And people don't write scripts like that for us. And it was something that I wanted for a long time. And then also this prospect of working with Michelle Yeoh was enormous. You know, I grew up watching her movies and I was a fan of hers for decades. And I was really nervous. So I got myself an acting coach to coach me for the audition, went in there, thought I did really well. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't hear from them for two months. So any hope that I had.
It took you 2 weeks to get a call for an audition and then 2 months to.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything from them. And so I thought, you know, any hope of me landing this role was completely gone. And thank God they called me again. I went in there to audition for the second time. And then briefly after that, they told me I got the role. And it was just, I mean, it was one of the happiest days of my life. I wanted this so bad. We were just talking about how, you know, how big the lottery is. You know, honestly, if you ask me then, do I want to win the lottery or do I want to win this role? I would have told you without a doubt, I wanted this. That's how hungry I was for this. How eager I was for it. And it's been incredible since.
I imagine in my head, I just imagine you having a conversation with your wife, similar to like any cop movie where he says, I'm going back in, you know, and the wife's like, but no, you said you were going to be out now and now you're going back in. For a lot of people who don't know, what took you away from the industry? You know, we knew you in Indiana Jones, the Temple of Doom. We knew you in The Goonies. And then we didn't hear from you again. So what pulled you out of it?
Well, you know, I was very lucky when I was a little kid. I didn't go searching to be an actor. Acting found me. Mm-hmm. And I started at the very, very top, working with Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and Harrison Ford. I mean, come on, that's a dream for any actor.
True.
You know? And then the follow-up movie was The Goonies. And so I thought it was, you know, the role would be that easy. You know, I was young, I was naive. But then as I got older, the road got progressively harder, more rugged, more bumpy. And then it was in my late teens and in my early 20s, I just found myself spending a lot of time waiting for the phone to ring, and it rarely rang. And I was just dispirited, despondent. And it was at a time where, you know, when you're in your 20s, it's supposed to be the golden years, you know. You're supposed to be out there doing all these crazy and wild things and fun things. But all I did was just, you know, sit by the phone and wait. And I would call my agent every, like, once in a long while and ask him if there's anything out there for me. And the answer would always be the same. No, I'm sorry, but if I see something, I'll call you back. And it was just, you know, for a long while, it wasn't fun anymore. All those great things that I was, you know, experiencing on my first two movies, all of that was gone. And I was just faced with an uncertain future. I didn't know what to do. I was so lost. And I debated for the longest time because it was so painful to step away from something that I loved dearly, but I just didn't have a choice. So I enrolled myself in film school. I went to USC Film School and graduated.
You're a Trojan.
It one of the greatest film school ever. And I graduated in 99. And started working behind the camera since.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's what you were doing for a lot of that time. You were just working in productions, but behind the scenes.
Yeah. You know, I love movie making. I love this industry. I love this world. And I didn't want to completely step away from it.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to learn more about it. So yeah. So when I graduated, I was working a lot in Hong Kong for a filmmaker named Wong Kar-wai, who we dedicated an entire universe to in The Mood for Love. Yeah. I mean, in our movie, Everything Everywhere All at Once. And I also worked for an action director named Koi Yuan for a number of years. So I was just having fun working behind the camera. until 2018.
When you get this audition.
When a movie called The Crazy Rich Asians came out. And I went to see it in the movie theater three times, cried every single time. And I had serious FOMO watching my fellow Asian actors up on the screen doing wonderful work. And I wanted to be up there with them. And that was really when that the idea of being an actor started taking place.
That is the, I speak a lot of my platform here and my entire career has been talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, and those moments that you can't quantify. And because Crazy Rich Asians exists, besides being a box office sensation, proving that other stories that aren't just white can make money, here it is on screen inspiring kids, but also a 48-year-old at the time, 47-year-old at the time, to get back into the game. And you can't quantify that in a boardroom or a pitch room or meeting. So that it just feels really good to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, that's why representation is important. Because who knows who you can inspire. It was definitely, you know, it's not until you see yourself up there that you think it's possible. And honestly, I mean, not just for Asian Americans, but I think all groups of people should have a voice. And our medium is really powerful. When you get to see yourself represented, it's a wonderful thing.
It's awesome. No, thank you for sharing that. So when you went in for your audition, back to your audition for a second, it's weird to ask, but did the Daniels know who you are when you already walked in? I just want to know, throughout your life, how many short rounds do you hear screamed at you just like walking down the street that you're just like, guys, like,
you know, for the longest time, every time I go on an audition, you know, the casting director would recognize me.
Oh, really? Okay.
And this is, you know, I mean, in my earlier years too, they would say, oh my God, you know, you're short round. Mm-hmm. You were great in The Goonies. Yeah. You were great in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And I was really happy to hear that, thinking that it would help me in some way to land the role. But the majority of the time, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So this time, I mean, the Daniels knew who I was walking in, and they were very generous, they were very kind, and they made me really comfortable when I was in the room with them and our casting director, Sarah Finn. The whole time they were directing me, which this was the first audition in decades, and I was really nervous.
Do you remember the last film you auditioned for before you called it quits?
The last time was in 1993.
No.
I went in, and this was maybe a year and a half without a single audition, without a single opportunity. My agent called me and says, Key, there's this little role. I don't know if you're interested. It has two lines. The character didn't have a name, but I was so hungry. I hadn't worked for a year and a half. And I said, yeah, of course I would go and audition for it. So I went in, I walked in the room, and there was 30 other Asian actors, fighting for this tiny role. And again, yeah, I walked in, the casting director knew who I was. I did my thing, went home, waited an entire week, thinking, you know, my agent would call me and tell me the good news. He didn't. I called him instead and asked him, you know, what's the status of that? And he told me this devastating news. And says, you know, I think they went with a different direction. They picked somebody else.
Do you remember the movie?
No. I don't remember. But I do remember sitting at the edge of my bed after I hung up the phone. I sat there for the longest time. It's got to be like an hour, just thinking, "What the hell am I doing here?" You know, I was not at a good place, So that was the last time I auditioned. So, and needless to say, when I was auditioning for the Daniels, I was super nervous. My heart was pounding the entire time, and I think they noticed that. So they, you know, in the very beginning, they just had a really nice chat to try to calm me down.
Yeah.
And the whole time that I was auditioning, they were giving me directions behind the camera. And immediately, all those wonderful memories that I had on the set of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came flooding back, very similar to the way Steven Spielberg directed me when I was a little kid. And I was having a lot of fun. I loved the directions they were giving me. I felt like I was acting again. And I felt really good leaving that audition.
Yeah.
But then again, I mean, landing this role at that time seemed so far-fetched. And honestly, for me, having not, done it for more than 20 years, just getting any job as an actor seemed so distant and difficult to me at that time. So you can only imagine how happy I was when I got the phone call.
Oh, God. It's very happy. Like, not a lot of happy stories in this town. Sometimes it's especially for people of color, it's like,
but that was my first audition in over more than 2.5 decades. The interesting thing is, after I did this movie, and of course, the entire world was shut down for the pandemic.
Oh yeah, there was a pandemic going on.
Yeah, and our movie hasn't come out, and I was auditioning. I kept looking for my next job, yeah. But a lot of them were self-taped. And for 2.5 years, or the duration of the pandemic, I've done maybe 20 to 30 auditions, and I did not get one single job. During this 2.5 year period, I did not get one callback, and I was miserable. Our movie hasn't come out, and everything that I was experiencing when I was much younger, I was experiencing again. But in a much shorter period of time. When I was younger, it was for years and years. But this was for maybe, I would say, 2 years. And I would audition for movies, television series, series regular roles. And finally, I was so desperate for a job. I called my agent up, and I was on the verge of losing my health insurance. And I said, just please give me anything, any guest starring roles in anything. And he got me those auditions. I did not get those either. Ugh. It was nothing. And I think there was even at a time where my agent was losing faith in me.
Yeah.
I was losing faith in myself. I hadn't seen the movie. The Daniels were very, gracious. They asked me if I wanted to see it, but I was too nervous. I said, no, I'm going to wait until, the movie comes out, then I'll watch it. And I remember calling my producer, our producer, Jonathan Wong. And I said, Jonathan, oh my God, I must suck. I cannot get one single job. Nobody wants to hire me, And he says, Key, just wait. Just be patient. He was very sweet. And I was so nervous. And everything changed when our movie came out. Everything changed.
Obviously, more than insurance, it just gave you that hope.
Yeah, and it validated. It gave me this huge validation that I can do this.
Yeah.
I even, at one point during the pandemic, I even joked. I said, nobody wants to hire me except Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, Wong Kar-wai, and the Daniels. Nobody else.
Yeah.
And when our movie came out,
by the way, good company to people that want you.
Yeah, and then one day I got a call from Kevin Feige, telling me that he saw the movie, and told me how much he loved the movie, and he asked me to join the MCU family on Loki season 2, and then I went back and I told the Daniels and Jonathan Wong, I said, nobody wants to hire me except, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, the Daniels, Wong Kar-wai, and now Kevin Feige, which was an incredible feeling.
You could be bougie about it. Only the top Hollywood producers, A-listers
this is so true. I was so, nervous. And all those horrible memories that I had when I was in my late teens and early 20s, and those auditions that I had when I was younger, and they came far and few in between. And no matter how small the role is, I could not land the job. And for the longest time, I thought, you know, I thought it was me. I thought I wasn't good enough. I thought I wasn't tall enough or good looking enough. Because, you know, I never went through the proper training as an actor. And I always felt inferior to, you know, to whoever got the job. You know, every time I watch it, I go, oh my God, that actor deserves it much better than me. He's so much better than me. And again, I was experiencing all of that during the entire pandemic. Every tape that I sent in. I waited for the, you know, I was by my phone again, waiting for my agent to call and tell me not just that I got the role, but perhaps maybe a callback, mm-hmm. hoping, you know, a callback to meet with the director or the producer and to have an opportunity again to show them that I'm capable of doing this. And it was none of that. And of course, 2021 went by, and I lost my health insurance. And so right before our movie came out, yeah. That's why I've been overwhelmed with emotions for the last 6 months, especially when, you know, reading some of the comments. Anyway, first of all, very, very sorry. My wife told me, Key, you've been crying too much. Don't cry.
I
apologize.
It's
I'm not really good at this.
You and, never, listen, yeah. I am a baby. I cry and everything. And this is, these are happy tears. This is
yes,
like,
yes, definitely
these are,
happy
these tears. Are relief tears. These are like, there's a lot of things tied into this. I mean, if you stubbed your toe and cried, I'd be upset with you.
But these are certainly happy tears. I'm in a very, very good place. I'm in a very grateful place.
And that's Kiyu Kwan, star of Everything Everywhere All at Once. From A24, it's now in theaters and on demand. Directed by Antoine Fuqua. Written by Bill Collage, and produced by Todd Black, Joey McFarlane, John Mohn, and Will Smith. Apple Original Films' Emancipation tells the story of a runaway slave who navigates the swamps of Louisiana on an arduous journey to escape the plantation owners who nearly killed him. Of course, much of the conversation surrounding the film will focus on star Will Smith, who must win back the good graces of Hollywood after his infamous slap of Chris Rock at last year's Oscars telecast. Smith stars as Peter, a runaway slave who flees Louisiana in hopes of traveling north to freedom. But keep an eye on Ben Foster, recently seen as the star of Barry Levinson's Holocaust biopic The Survivor, which was nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Television Movie. In Emancipation, he plays Fassel, a man who doggedly pursues any enslaved person who attempts to flee to freedom, which also includes Peter. I recently spoke with Foster about the role and the busy year that he's had.
When Antoine called me up,
Is that normal for you, by the way? Does he just call Ben Foster sometimes?
It's the first time Antoine called me. But I'm afraid it was like Antoine wants to speak with you. So, yes, sir. Big fan of his. And I was prepping another job. And he sent me the script and read the script of Emancipation, and it was such a great read. And rather than being a dusty historical movie about a very ugly topic, it felt that the design of it was entertaining, mm-hmm. historically accurate. Or at least in honor of true events, and when I read it and I talked to him, I'm like, why are you calling me for this right now? I have two kids. Call me for a romantic comedy. Like, why this guy right now?
Yeah,
right now. And he said, I want to lift the veil. And I couldn't quite process what that meant.
Yeah.
And I said, well, love the script, love you, love Will Smith, think it's an important piece. You're going to do something tremendous, yeah. I don't know if I want to think about this.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to think about this.
Yeah.
And I, as you brought up earlier, the Survivor I spent time in Auschwitz researching the extermination of 6 million human beings. So the idea of investigating the scars that America has left and how we're still experiencing the wounds of just felt like a weight I didn't want to look at. But I couldn't sleep that night.
Mm-hmm.
And his words kept echoing. So I went on a research spiral of what does lifting the veil mean for systemic racism in our country? Not a simple question to mm-hmm. answer. And without getting too far into it, the character as written, Bill College wrote a great script. The character signaled white devil from the South with snakeskin boots. And it was very eccentric, really mm-hmm. eccentric character, which my younger years, I probably would have. It's been like, oh, that's the guy. Oh, yeah. Mom, that's Chewy.
Mm-hmm.
And something about it just, I couldn't get my head around. And on the 4th of July, I was on the way to some picnic with my kids and my wife. And in my news feed, Frederick Douglass's What Does 4th of July Mean?
Mm.
And I read that. And the character came into full focus. And I called him on the 4th on my way to the picnic. I was like, I have an idea.
It's company holiday, man.
It's company holiday. Everybody's on barbecues and you're like, hey, I want to talk about
Emancipation.
Yeah. I have a thought. He's like, I'm at a thing. And so I sent him, and it's well known, Frederick Douglass is what it is. 4th of July, I mean. And he called me right away. And I said, here's the thought. You want to lift the veil about the white racist in America? We take him out of the South first. Not everyone in the South is a racist. Not everyone in the North is a civil rights activist.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to make him the guy that could be a farmer, the pastor, your next door neighbor. We put him in the plains. Let's take all the sugar off this character. So there's nothing scarier than somebody that you could just see next door.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I'm in. I said, all right, well, let's go. And that was 6 days before we started shooting. So it was a complete redesign and we stripped it and had some of the more enlightening, hard conversations about why are we still dealing with this?
Yeah.
So we started exchanging essays. James Baldwin in particular was big. The reading list was immense. It was a big dive cast, 1619 project. And we just started sharing what is the core of this racist man. And it's white fear. So you get down to what is white fear. And that was extraordinary to talk with Antoine about and explore the guilt of having done, or at least the awareness of having done something so impossible to a fellow human being. How do we get into the engine of that?
It's interesting you say that, because when I was watching the film, I'm reminded there's a common theme I keep coming to as I was watching it. Like, what does freedom actually mean? Like, what that word we say and people just say as talking points of, you know, why we should do certain legislation or why people should be able to say whatever they want. So it's freedom. What does freedom actually mean? And who holds the keys to that door in the world? And when I was watching you, I'm reminded of other great performances in history, like Michael Fassbender in 12 Years a Slave, Ralph Fiennes in Schindler's List. I thought of a lot. I said that I feel like this is Antoine Fuqua's Schindler's List. It's everything it needs to be. It's not pretty in the sense of what it depicts. Robbie Richardson is on loan from heaven as a cameraman. Like,
he's one of our finest cinematographers at the top of his game.
Like, unreal how beautiful that he makes that movie just look in such a gruesome way. But I was thinking about that freedom aspect. Where did you pull from? Because I know, and everyone hopefully knows, this is the polar opposite of Ben Foster. And so you have to get to an ugly place that you are not in favor of in this world. How do you get there and then come out of it whole?
Well, I come from a family that have fought for civil rights for generations. My grandfather, my grandmother, my father marched with Martin Luther King a month after Selma in Boston with 20,000 people. I mean, these are Jewish immigrants, the Romanian, Ukrainian immigrants. My grandfather picketed outside of Woolworths in the 50s. Only picketer, by the way, because people of color were not allowed to eat at the cafe table. So the way that I was raised reading this script is saying, yes, we need to talk about this, but no, I don't want to ask these questions. And part of that, when I got the call from Antoine, was like, this is everything I don't want to look at. And then I'm not on social media. I'm not outward with speaking politics. But upon that call with Antoine and discussing how do we talk about, how do we show, rather than just villainizing systemic racism, who is the individual? How does it happen? Where does it come from? Mm. So the education began. We're not taught these things in school. Mm-hmm. So a deep honor to speak with him. And I mean that an honor because it's raw, man. It's raw. And what he pulled off with this film and the way he came to set every day was like a prize fighter coming to fight for love. The messaging is love. The message of the film, if we can talk about it, is the will to survive against impossible odds. So having just done The Survivor, playing a man who was in a concentration camp and had to escape, had to fight his fellow Jews to the death on the other side of the wire, yeah, to have the opportunity to then re-examine something which was so shocking, to feel the similarities. We shot in Louisiana on plantations, work camps, where men, women, and children were worked to death. When we visited Auschwitz for The Survivor, it marks your being. However you want to talk about it, it changes your life view in a visceral way. And I felt the same way when we walked on those plantations. And seeing those two, what we do to each other as human beings, what we have done, and in spite of that, we can still remember that no matter how bad it gets, the human spirit or the will for your family, however you want to frame it, can do impossible things for good. So it was a great gift to be able to ask these awful questions. There's a book that was very influential, which is kind of tangentially connected. It's called Without Sanctuary, and it has fabulous, but insightful essays, Frederick Douglass, James Baldwin, great thinkers of, but it's a photo document of the lynchings in America. And one of the essays talked about the ruthless matter-of-factness of racism. Mm. Matter-of-factness. And so that stuck in my head.
Yeah.
And we just kept going further. It's just, this is a job. This man is in charge of a work camp. Lincoln has said, emancipation is happening, but it hasn't trickled down yet. So we're dealing with human assets. And what was so frightening as we explored Fassel, the character of Fassel, was saying, well, what if this man isn't just a scary racist, but it's matter-of-fact work? And something that Antoine said to me that was so resonates today was talking about mental slavery. Mm. And this goes back to your question about what is freedom? What does that word mean? Who controls my freedom? Is there a big group of people who are not? Is it my life circumstance? Is it partly mental? Is it my conditioning? And one of the great directions he gave me, he said, the reason you need to go after Peter, who's played by Will Smith, who I think does the finest work of his career in this film, was that he's mentally free. And that drives Fassel, I don't say crazy, but obsessed. Because if you can control someone's mental state, mm-hmm. then you control their body. Then you can control people. And that's a virus, and fear is a virus, and it spreads. So if you can't break this guy, you've got to do every possible way to get him under your thumb. So those questions were every day. How do you get mentally free?
That is a very insightful way to put it, because I was thinking about that. I do see how that drive is almost like a cancer inside of Fassel. Like it drives him nuts throughout the movie and drives his motivation to track him and continue to pursue him. I have to ask about the shoot that rumor has it was a little difficult because a major weather event took place, a hurricane. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with climate change, obviously.
That's not real.
It was just water.
It's just water.
Just a lot of water.
Yeah, no, it's.
But you can see it like all over the screen. Like you can like see, like you almost feel the hurricane on frames, like and coming and like all about like what was that like and. Again, Robbie Richardson, I don't know what he stood on. We have to protect him at all costs. I don't know how he was getting these shots, the field and everything.
Bob Richardson is a sorcerer. I will follow him to the gates of hell.
Yeah.
That man, and you feel his presence the way that anybody who has devoted their life, you feel them. It could be a boxer. It could be a nun. He's a cinematographer. Bob Richardson walks on set. Mm. He's not making a big show, but watching him look at light, it is one of the finest joys I've. And getting to spend a little bit of time with him, he's one of our greats. He's one of the greatest cinematographers of all time. Mm. And what he did with Emancipation is. So elevated and refined in its brutality.
That's Ben Foster, star of Emancipation, which hits select theaters on December 2nd before launching December 9th on Apple TV+. And that's it for this edition of the Variety Award Circuit podcast. Drew Griffith edited this episode and Michael Schneider is the producer. Be sure to subscribe to the Award Circuit podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com and click on the Award Circuit tab to find the latest awards predictions and key races, as well as your daily fix of news, analysis, and reviews. For Jazz Tanke, Janelle Riley, and Michael Schneider, I'm Clayton Davis. We'll see you on the circuit.